The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com. Welcome to the Helicaster Jane Show. I am Helicaster Jane. Let's talk. The movies you watch, the TV shows you adore, the concerts and sporting events you attend. Behind the curtain of nearly all of these is an immensely powerful corporation known as Creative Artists Agency. In the first half hour, we talk with award-winning journalist and author of Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency, James Andrew Miller, who has spun a tale of boundless ambition, ruthless egomania, ceaseless empire building, greed, and personal betrayal. And that's just the beginning. In our second half hour, it's our four broads talking politics, and you never know what, with our panel of smart, feisty broads, Sheila Weller, Lisa Schifrin, Susanna Andrews, and me, Helicaster Jane. So stay tuned, but before we begin, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by our new partner, Kobo, for all your e-reading services. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com. The movies you watch, the TV shows you adore, the concerts and sporting events you attend. Behind the curtain of nearly all of these is an immensely powerful corporation known as Creative Artist Agency. Started in 1975, when five bright and brash employees of a creaky William Morris office left open their own strikingly innovative talent agency, CAA would come to revolutionize the entertainment industry, and over the next several decades, its tentacles would spread aggressively beyond film and television into music, advertising, and investment banking. In Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency, James Andrew Miller, the award-winning journalist and co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Those Guys Have All the Fun, Inside the World of ESPN, and Live from New York, who has written for The Washington Post, The New York Times, and Vanity Fair, among others, spins a tale of boundless ambition, ruthless egomania, ceaseless empire building, greed, and personal betrayal. Let's talk.
Okay, James, I love this book. I told you off air I love this book, and I'm not joking. Everybody has to read this. This is like one of the best reads I've done in a long time. It's fun. It's informative. Oh, my God, what you've done here. And I like the structure of it as well, but let me get started. I want to start backwards in a way, if that's okay with you. I want you to tell us where CAA stands today in the lexicon of the great talent agency. It's 41 years after its beginnings. Who runs the company now? How's it doing?
Well, it's doing pretty damn well. And it's one of the reasons why I thought it was a great way to kind of talk about Hollywood and what's going on, not only in the future, but what's gone on the past 40 years. It is a remarkably powerful agency. It has a lot of influence. It's in our lives. You know, even for people who don't know what those initials are, CAA, what does that mean? Believe me, when you go to bed with Jimmy Fallon at night, when you get in your car and you turn on the radio and it's Katy Perry, when you watch Game of Thrones, when you watch a Tom Cruise or Meryl Streep movie, I mean, CAA is part of your own ecosystem in a way that you might not be aware of. Even when you walk into a Chipotle, I mean, CAA advises and does marketing with Chipotle, so it's kind of everywhere.
Okay, so knowing that it's had a long road, right, filled with ups, downs, twists, and turns, I know that from reading the book, it earned its stripes as a Hollywood legend, much like the clients it's represented. So let's go back to that beginning, the players. I mean, James, if women are writing a script, you could not have built better characters to get you going than this story has, right? I mean, five employees who left, you described as creaky William Morris. Let me just finish, and the young men. Let's take a look at them, and you just tell me what you want. Just talk, buddy. Let's just hear what you got to say. Go.
Well, no, I mean, you know, somebody accused me of making them up, you know, and making a lot of this up. And I said, no, I promise. I'm actually a journalist, and I do pride myself on the nonfiction world. But I think to your point, I mean, so many of the things that happen are so kind of crazy and dramatic, even by Hollywood standards, that you kind of like scratch your head and you think, wait a second, you know, what's going on here? And I think that was part of the fun thing. To talk about.
let's look at each of these guys, okay? There were five of them initially. They all had worked for, at the time, the agency, which was William Morris. Right. And they were going to leave, maybe, and they were caught, so they had to leave sooner rather than later. Okay, we can get into that in a little bit. But let's look at them, because they really are a cast of characters. There was Mike Ovitz. There was Mike Rosenfeld. There was Ron Meyer, Bill Haber, Ron Perkins. Talk to me a little bit about each of them. I'll throw out a name and just kind of give us a little insight into who these guys were. Mike Rosenfeld, because I want to stay at the beginning. I think it's so extraordinary.
Well, I mean, Mike Rosenfeld was a lovable, dear man. Everybody loved. He was at William Morris. And I think that one of the things that, stuck with me was his son remembering when he left William Morris to start the Sea Agent. His son asked, Mike Rosenfeld asked his son and his other son if they had any money in their piggy bank, because it was going to be, tough to start this new company.
Think about that. How crazy is that? Let's look at Ovitz, because, oh my gosh, right? I mean, what a character.
I heard of him.
I heard of him. What's your take on him overall?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners to first know that he was the youngest and the least experienced of the five co-founders. And within, a decade, he was being called the most powerful man in Hollywood. So put everything else aside, that journey, with all its Shakespearean complexities, is, pretty wild ride.
Pretty wild.
And then you have Ron Meyer, who, is still chairman of Universal and was a very, very big part of CA, who is just like this amazing creature. I must tell you, during the interviews for this book, I had more people tell me, by the way, I'm Ron Meyer's best friend. And I didn't have the heart to tell them that like 70 other people thought they were too. I mean, how does this guy pull it off? It's crazy. Women love him. Guys want to be their best friend. It was incredible. And then there's Bill Haber, who was just wicked smart and very much a quixotic, eccentric personality. So the combination of all five is just, you just wouldn't, you wouldn't put them together naturally. And the funny thing is also, as I point out, they didn't really know each other all that well.
I also think, there was magic, and it was the sum of the parts was the magic for sure. I mean, it would change, obviously, but in that very beginning. I also want to give credit, as you do in the book, to the wives, because things were so bad. They didn't have a I said this to a friend of mine. She never heard the expression. She lives in Europe, pot to piss in to start with. But they got the wives came in. The wives were the secretaries. I mean, this, when you think about how it was started on the shoestring, right? Extraordinary to where it is today.
It was really important for me to mention the role that the wives played, because, they literally had folding card tables as desks when they first started out. And the wives took turns being secretaries and answering the phone and doing other things. And so I think that, they're to be celebrated and appreciated in a very important way.
So talk to me this. You have spoken to 99.9% of Hollywood background for this book. Why now did you do it, first of all? Why were everybody so willing to talk to you, and maybe you should have worked with CAA as an agent with the skills that you have to get everybody to talk? I've never seen a book like this where you got to so many people to say so many things.
Well, I was really pleased that they cooperated. And I just, one of the things that you have to do when you're doing a book like this is you have to beg and you have to plead. And I can't tell you how appreciative. I mean, people like, from Tom Cruise to Sylvester Stallone, Nicole Kidman, Sarah Jessica Parker, Jennifer Lopez, and on and on and on. It was really amazing to me that they were able to do that, to give me that time.
Not to mention the guys. Talk to me about this. I mean, were you surprised at how forthcoming some of them were? Honest. There was a lot of honesty.
I was. I mean, that's one of the things that I think, it happened with the Saturday Night Live book that I did, an ESPN book, but even more so now, because I think people, last night at a restaurant, I'm in LA, and last night at a restaurant, somebody came up and said, look, I can't believe, you talked to these people, but also I can't believe what they told you. I think people are really honest in the book, and they're really raw. And I think that that's a very important, you know, that's a very important item.
Well, you know what it struck me as? This is why it struck me. It struck me because having spent a lot of time in Hollywood myself and understanding, you know, the reputation that it has, if not always the truth. But you know, nobody thinks Hollywood's real. This book is so real. And this is the people who make Hollywood who are so real. That astonished me, that irony. Did it astonish you?
I think so. I think that's really well put. It did, and it continued to astonish me during the 3 years of reporting the book. Well, you know, you had this sense. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was talking to Sylvester Stallone about when Ron Meyer called him and said he was no longer going to be his agent. And Sylvester Stallone started like telling me about how they both were crying on the phone, and then how Sylvester Stallone afterwards wrote Ron a poem. I was like, wait, what? I mean, you're continually astonished and surprised.
Right. Because I think there is a lot. I think one of the big revelatory parts of this book of yours is it does paint a very different picture of Hollywood relationship than most of us have. And, you know, that says a lot about your reporting, by the way, as well, because you can get people to say, you know, get down to the gut, get down to the truth. Like I said, I love this book. Okay, talk to me about it. It could have been called Chutzpah Artist Management, by the way. I mean,
Oh, that's so funny.
These guys have more chutzpah than anything.
That's so funny.
It's so true, though, isn't it? I mean, think about tell us some of the crazy things they did in the beginning. I mean, like, just the Jaguar story or what they did with Variety. Give everybody a sense of the last address in Beverly Hills. Tell us who these guys and how clever they are.
Well, I think, you know, for the Jaguars, they actually took a loan out in order to get five Jaguars with CA 1, 2, 3, 4 CA plates so they could project an image of success. And, you know, it was one of the ways in which they branded themselves, which I thought was brilliant.
And that's the thing. A lot of people are good at branding other people. That's another thing that kind of shocked me is how good they were at branding themselves, which is where I think a lot of people, you know, the reason they hire a CAA is because they aren't good at branding themselves. But these guys could not only brand somebody else, but they were able to brand themselves as well. They had a logo made and they put an ad in Variety that was just the logo. I mean, like, you know, with a finger up to WME, or it wasn't WME at the time, but at William Morris, who they were about to crush. Think about it. I mean, it's just really it's fascinating. It's utterly fascinating.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that I think you're hitting on is the fact that these young guys were so able to brand themselves and that they were going to disrupt the current climate. They didn't care that William Morris had been around for 100 years. They were going to, you know, do it their way, and they were going to change the rules. I mean, they got these big, you know, these bold script covers that were red with the CA logo on it. And so they started leaving them in doctor's offices. So people would start seeing, you know, CA and start to think, wait, what is this? I mean, it's really some of the things that they did were really impressive. And every single week in the trades, they were announcing all their new clients. So if you're on, you know, on the other end, the competition, you're starting to see these ads every week about they're signing this one and they're signing this one, and then Sean Connery and Paul Newman and Robert Redford and everything else. It gets a little depressing.
Really, right? And you thought you were in control, you know, and then you find out, no, not so much. These guys are full steam ahead. They had a philosophy, and I think you said it was the Three Musketeers philosophy. Talk to me about that a little bit, because I think that does say why this was so successful in the early days.
Yeah, that was pretty cool, which is, you know, one for all and all for one. I think the concept of team was something that was really important for CA, particularly, you know, at the beginning. William Morris was the big dog in town, but it was very hierarchical. You know, you could work there for years and not get to speak at a staff meeting or even have, you know, one of the big shots know your name. And CA tore down those walls, so to speak, and they made it more about, you know, a team effort as opposed to individuals. And when you think about the culture, you know, statement that makes, I think that's really very, you know, very interesting. And it wound up being a great selling point for people coming over there.
Yeah, and I think at one point in the book you talk about the fact that if one couldn't close the deal, they could lean on the other and say, you close it. I just don't have the rapport with this particular person, and you probably can do it. I mean, it really was became this extraordinary team effort. Again, I want to reiterate, in a town where there's no such thing, according to folklore.
Or if your client, at William Morris, if a client was given a movie offer, and you know, here's the script, does she want to do the part? You know, the actress would read the part, talk about it with the agent. The agent would call back and say, no, she doesn't want to. At CAA, they were instructed, if your client didn't want to do it, talk to everybody else about what the part was. So a lot of times they were calling back saying, you know, Sally Field doesn't want to do it, but Goldie Hawn wants to do it. Or Robert Redford doesn't want to do it, but Paul Noon wants to do it. I mean, just think about, it seems kind of natural and obvious to run a business like that. But at the time, it wasn't. And I think that that gave CA a really distinct competitive advantage.
Not to jump ahead, but I will. Let's talk Mike Ovitz a little bit, because what happened to him and his career, for starting there and then, of course, moving on, that story is pretty wild. He winds up, and this guy has some kind of power. Talk to me about the power he has. I mean, what was his line? He said, I want to have fun. I want to do... make money, and I want to have power, not necessarily, I guess, in those order. The guy just amassed enormous power. He also fell from grace, but talk to me.
Well, I think it was very, very important to him. He wanted to be the most powerful man in Hollywood. He wound up being the most powerful man in Hollywood. And then, just like we know from Greek mythology, you know, sometimes that means that you fly too close to the sun. And I think that, you know, Michael Ovitz, one of the things that happened when he was becoming the most powerful man in Hollywood was that he was also ticking a lot of people off. And so there was some resentment toward him when he used the sledgehammer, that he did. And so I think people, when he started to not have the power, kind of rejoiced and were glad to see, you know, him fade away. And I think that's just... you know, just one of those Shakespearean tales that it just goes to show you that, you know, sometimes when the Lord wants to punish you, he answers your prayers.
Good line. There's another thing, and that is they changed the business. And I want to touch on that here first. At the end, I want to go and explore that just a little bit more. But just here, the concept of packaging was new to the biz. That was something that they came up with, putting a director, putting the package together and then selling it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I mean, look, there had been, I guess, you know, look, there had been packages before, see, but I think that they took it to new levels. And, you know, one of the things that happened was, like, when they read the script for Rain Man, I mean, I think from the moment that Ovitz read that script, there was no way that CA clients were not going to be involved in it. And there was going to be, you know, more than likely, CA director and CA stars. And that's exactly what happened. Barry Levinson and Dustin Hoffman and obviously Tom Cruise, they were part of the CA world. So it wasn't just, let's get this made. It's how can we get this made inside? In fact, there's a couple of people tell the story of the fact that a lot of casting sessions for movies were actually cast out of CA. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, if you're an agent at another agency, you have to like send your client over to CAA to read for a part. I mean, that's like at that point, you know, somebody said they were like shooting, ducks in a barrel, because, you know, it's like you're treated so well and how are you? And oh, my gosh, what a great office. And all that, you know, like, no joke. I mean, that's one of the reasons why, you know, some people go over there and never come back.
It's true. Listen, unbelievable stories in this book. And we have to touch on one or two. But you have got to tell the audience the Peter Sellers story. Oh, my God, that is Adam. What Adam Fields? Now, it's not an original guy, but it's one of the agents. Tell us that story. That is ridiculous.
That was fun. Yeah, I mean, look, actually, Adam Fields at the time, I mean, he's now a producer, but at the time, he was just an assistant. And Peter Sellers was a client of Marty Baum, who was Adam was working for, and he basically had demanded that this producer, who he had just fired recently, come back to Paris to be on the set. And he wasn't going to get back on the set unless the producer was there. So, you know, Adam Field's boss said, you better have that producer on tonight's flight to Paris. And Adam had to track him down. And, you know, this is before 9/11 security, but he said, you got to go over to LAX. The plane leaves in 20 minutes. And the guy said, I'll never be able to get there. He said, just go over there. Don't worry about it. And Adam Field went to a payphone and called in a bomb threat. I mean, so the plane would be delayed and the guy would make the plane. And he did. I mean, that's the kind of
craziness.
I think that's the kind of thing that you want in an assistant, I guess. But
this is just
story
how, yeah.
So hilarious.
This is how this company worked, though. This is how they did the deals that they did. I mean, this is what made them so unique. And a business up until that time, of course, with William Morris being this old stage, you know, you do it this way. These guys just broke every darn rule that there was to break. There are other stories. They abound all through the book. So, I mean, you have to read the whole book to really chuckle your way through a long weekend. That's all that I can tell, because I certainly did. Sarah Jessica Parker, she didn't want the role in Sex and the City. I mean, it's crazy stuff in here.
Right. Like, and Cher didn't want the role in Moonstruck, and Ron Meyer had to talk her into that. You know, I think one of the things that I tried to do was I tried to include enough stories where people get a sense of what agents really do. And I think that, you know, that's something that people, I mean, just think about how many, I mean, Cher won the Academy Award for that. Nicole Kidman said the same thing about The Hours, the movie The Hours, and she won the Academy for that. So I think you start to see that
the
you
Midas
know, these
touch.
Agents have really, really important roles.
Right, and they have the Midas touch. So you do all this research, you talk to all of these people. Oh my gosh, James, you have to tell me. At the end of the day, what one thing about all of this did you, either were you most surprised about, or you didn't know, or you think is the most important thing we can learn from all of this? What was the one thing that you that just got to you and you went, whoa?
I think the benefits of drinking heavily after you finish a book like this. No, I'm just kidding. I think you start to, you know, sometimes we have a tendency to think of like grains of sand about like individual things we hear in Hollywood. And what I try to do is, I think when I put it all together, that you start to see really what Hollywood's like, and it's very very crazy place, and it's big business, and it's more important than ever now, and that's one of the things that's impacting our lives in such a, you know, truly profound way. I like the idea that we have. Right now, at this moment in time, we have all these like shows coming at us on Netflix and Amazon, and movies are changing, and we can get all this information on our phone and everything else. But at the end of the day, like a company like CAA, even if we don't know what it was before, we can see now how they're organizing themselves and what it's like to get all this information and this content, this entertainment to us. And so in some ways, it helps. You know, I'm really gratified by people who are reading it now and saying that they kind of have a better understanding of what it's all about out there now.
So there is this question, you know, you got to look at it this way. I mean, for instance, in 2015, CAA represented more Academy Award winners than the next three agencies combined. Billboard named CAA Music of the Agency of the Year for 9 of the past 12 years. They represented a trifecta of executive producer, director, and stars with Empire and Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead. I mean, just think about the grand, amazing thing that these guys have built. But, you know, I have to ask you this. The other side of the coin is something weird is happening in the business, and not everything is up to the par that it used to be, I think. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with me. In the businessifying of, you know, show biz, do we lose something in the translation? Is some of the creativity gone? Is because of the packaging, because of selling to Europe and or to Asia, because that's where movies are selling? Have we lost something? Or did they play fast and furious maybe with some of that which we held so high in high esteem? No more Gone with the Winds.
Yeah, you know, it's a really provocative question. And if I was a lawyer which I'm glad I'm not. But if I was a lawyer, I might say to you, do you want me to acquit or convict? Because I can actually support your statement, and then I can give you great examples that point the other way. I mean, I still think in television, there is amazing TV projects that television shows on the air that, you know, back in the old days of just three networks, they didn't exist. And I think that, you know, every day somebody comes up to me and said, oh my gosh, did you see The Night Before? Did you see this or that? And, you know, there's not enough time to see it all, but there's some really great stuff out there. I think the movie business, you know, really supports your point because there's less studios and there's less movies being made and they're all sequel crazy. You know, I mean, just to use the, you know, phrase that you use, yeah, with Fast and Furious 8, although I happen to love those movies. But I mean, my point is, it's not the rich kind of movies that we saw in the, particularly like in the 70s when CA started. The 1970s was such an unbelievable time for movies. And, you know, and in, even into the 80s. So I think that the movie business may not be, you know, what we used to associate it with, although that still doesn't mean that there can't be great movies from time to time. But I guess, you know, the most important thing is that there's just this crazy world out there, and we're just trying to make sense of it now because technology has just thrown everything off, right? I mean, we can get all this content on even on our phones. So there's a lot of disruption, and everybody's trying to figure it out. But the one thing we do know is that we need great content. We need great storytelling, and that's why a place like CA is going to be so influential no matter what happens.
I'm going to finish with something that may surprise you. Ready for this?
No, seriously.
I told
you. Is this about my SAT scores?
No, but you want to whisper in my ear, I won't tell anybody.
I did really well on the verbal, but the math was, you know,
yeah, you
hard.
Too, huh? Me too. I was the same way. Oh, my gosh. What is that? It must be the creative part of our, you know, whatever. But listen to me. This is what I want to say to you. I really could not put this down, and I love this book, and I'm going to bat for you on this one. I only do stuff that I love, but I love this book. The history,
well, on behalf of my three children, God bless
okay,
you.
Okay, all right, so we'll do what we can. But here's the thing, the history, the innovation, the boundless ambition, the egomania, the greed, the personal betrayal, that's all there. That's what makes it a fun read. But, you know, there's something else I want to bring up here. This book should be a primer for every kid who's in college, who's in either business school or entertainment. This tells you how to do it and how not to do it. That is the magic of this story at the end of the day. Had you thought about that?
I'm so glad you said that because I have to tell you, one of the best things to happen this past week since the book has come out is that people are saying that I have bosses that are giving it to their assistants as presents. I have people have told me at other agencies that they're having, even though it's about CA, you know, it's still about Hollywood, but also just the idea of how you behave in an agency and some of the things in the workplace, I mean, not just an agency. And I think that I'm so glad you recognize that because, you know, one of the things that made me the most proud of the Saturday Night Live book was that Fortune called it one of the 75 best business books ever written, and even though it was about a comedy show. And I guess maybe it's my continued effort to justify my 2 years at business school, but I try, and even though we're talking about celebrities and power struggles and paranoia and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, I try also to include elements of, you know, organizational behavior and how the workplace works and how people get along with each other. And I was particularly intrigued by that in this book. So I can't thank you enough for recognizing that and for enjoying that, because it was definitely one of my goals.
I've been speaking with James Andrew Miller, author of Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency, by way of Custom House, an imprint of William Morrow. For more information about the book and James Andrew Miller, visit James on Twitter at Jim Miller. You are listening to The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. My guest today, the author of Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency, James Andrew Miller. And Sheila Weller, Suzanne Andrews, Lisa Schifrin, and me, our panel of four broads talking. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. And we are back on the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Thank you for being here. Okay, yep, they are back. Another edition of Four Broads Talking. Oh, and in case you don't remember from last week, our ladies, or broads, we go both ways, are Sheila Weller, Lisa Schifrin, Susanna Andrews, and me, Hallie Kasser-Jane. I'll be joining in as well as moderating. Okay, here we go. Our Four Broads Talking.
Well, here we are, guys, back on another segment of Four Broads Talking. Joining me at my table this week, three of the smartest broads that I know. So let me introduce them. It's true. First, Vanity Fair writer Susanna Andrews. Susanna, say hello to everybody.
Hello to everybody. Nice to be here.
Doesn't she follow orders well? We just love her. Okay, also joining us, another brilliant writer. And who didn't love her great book, Girls Like Us? Her name's Sheila Weller. Say hi, Sheila.
Thank you, Hallie. Hi, everybody.
Okay, It's Sheila. And Lisa Schifrin, our wonderful conservative, our resident conservative, political pundit, writer, all things politics, the girl is brilliant. Hi there, Lisa Schifrin.
Hi, Hallie. How are you?
I'm good. Not just to me. Say hi to your fellow broads. Say hello to
my fellow broads.
All right. So let's begin. Let's not waste any time. I want to begin with this, Russia and the Ukraine. And how did our former rival become so much a part of election 2016? Susanna, let's start with you and Donald Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, with the red hair that's beginning to look like Trump's, by the way. Just wanted to throw that in. Does anybody notice?
You noticed that, too?
You noticed it? Isn't that wild?
I think it's catching.
Whatever it is. Anyway, give us a little background on that.
Okay, so Paul Manafort, we have him actually, I guess it was revealed 2 days ago as a result of a corruption investigation in the Ukraine that there was a ledger on which it had been noted that Paul Manafort had received in cash $12.7 million for advising, I gather, the president, the pro- Russian president, and I'm so sorry I can never pronounce his name, but the one who was pushed out. And Paul Manafort has denied this. He said he never received the money. I guess the question is whether this is relevant. I mean, it's relevant if it's found that indeed it was the result of corruption, that the money was ill-gotten gains, and if he did receive it, and if he didn't declare it on his taxes. But otherwise, does it really matter? We already know that his candidate is sympathetic to strongmen.
I think what's weird here for me is all of this Russia stuff, how it's playing, right? Let me take you to the next thing that's on my brain, which is about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. I mean, personally,
whoa.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Whoa, whoa, whoa,
whoa. You got something more on there?
There are just 2 points there.
Go ahead.
One.
Yeah.
This is Lisa, right?
Yes, this is Lisa. I mean, first of all, we don't know if it's true or not, but let's assume it is. Paul Manafort is a political consultant. All top Washington political consultants on both sides of the aisle now work overseas. They work for whoever will pay them, pretty much. At first, it was just Britain. Then it was Britain and Israel. Now it's anywhere. So when there's an election, and regardless of how real the election is, these people get hired. This was well before he worked for Trump. So if he got paid, even if he got paid by a side we think of as strongmen who are not playing by the rules in a democracy, that is sort of within the bounds of legit, too.
I think I just said that.
I didn't hear that from you.
Yeah, you did. But, you know, you do raise another point, Lisa, which is, should these political operatives be paid for by foreign governments able to come back to the United States and work? That's kind of ugly to me. I think that's a conflict. Yeah, but that doesn't mean they should be allowed to do it. Maybe there should be some rules on the books.
No, wait a minute. In the old days, and I think this is still true for many of them, the way they made money in between election years was by working for corporations who continued to be their clients, even as they had political clients. Again, both sides of the aisle. Look, I am increasingly a Trump-like anti-globalist in this sense. I think there are more important values than pure money. So I'm with you on this, Hallie. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little ugly, but I also see no real way to limit it.
I don't think there is a way to limit it. What I have issue here is the only thing here is if the Ukrainians do find that this was the result, this money came from bribes, payoffs, etc., and Paul Manafort did take the money and did know about it and didn't declare it in his taxes, then you have an issue. Otherwise, you don't, I don't think.
Well, I don't think there's an answer to any of this. But I definitely think that it's a great thing to throw out there because it really does give fuel for thought. Politics is taking some strange turns. turns in these days.
It is. And the hyper-globalization of everything will pose problems for every country involved in any like triangle of goods, money, back and forth. Let me just say one more thing. Money, Russia. Who actually benefited the most from money directly from Russia? That would be the Clinton Foundation, the highly corrupt Clinton Foundation. We learned this week, but we've known all along, took many millions of dollars from Russia, in return for which the Secretary of State at the time, that would be Mrs. Clinton, gave them a deal that allowed them to buy 20% of America's uranium supply. To me, that's on its face far, far more corrupt and suggestive. And
you know I'm going to jump in on you. Oh, go ahead. Is that Is that Sheila? Go for it, Sheila.
Right here. Well, let's not forget a few weeks ago, Trump told Russia, release more of Clinton's emails. That he said it. Was that a joke? Was that one of Trump's sarcastic things? He says it, and then he says he didn't say it. It was sarcastic. It sounded real to me. Secondly, because I'm a big Page Six reader, is Wendy Deng Murdoch dating Vladimir Putin? And we certainly know that she and Ivanka Trump are on a vacation together, and also that Wendy and her children often go to the Kushners for Shabbat dinner, which is all very, very cute and snuggly. And I throw up my hands on that one.
Well, let me interject this. First of all, Lisa, there is no proof of any of this, number one. Number two, I'm going to have a problem with all... Wait a minute, I'm talking. I'm going to have a problem with all of this. I'm going to have a problem with the great Clinton Foundation that every CEO worldwide has given money to, who thinks it's the best thing in the world, being torn apart now because it's politically savvy for the right to do that. Let not forget, and I've seen it personally in Africa, the great work this foundation has done. Oh my gosh. So I think that we can't just throw that one out there. And I think it came up last week, and I said, let's just give it a moment for all of this to percolate before we take this on as a subject, because there are a lot of allegations and there's absolutely nothing more than that. And it looks like a political football to me. Again, personally, I know of the great work that they've done. And I think now it's being used in a way that I find very sad. Susanna, go ahead.
I think I agree with Hallie. I think they have done great work and they continue to do great work. And it was a great concept. However, I think the execution is getting very problematic. I really do. I think that you had an ex-president who set up a foundation with some really laudable goals, and you know he has his issues and yes, his connections, and you have to get a little messy when you're raising money. But anybody who thinks they're going to run for president one day needs to keep their nose clean and look ahead. And I think that Hillary Clinton has not been careful on that front, and she's gotten herself too entwined with the foundation. In fact, didn't she go and rename it? It's now the Hillary and Bill and Chelsea Foundation. And she did not have the kind of firewalls that she should have. I just think it's another case where, you know, they want their cake. She wants her cake and she wants to eat it too. And, you know, we haven't yet found any signs of, you know, overt sort of payoffs or bribery or corruption in that sense. But it's just smelly. And that's one of the things that makes her a difficult candidate to love.
Yeah. And I wonder, though, you know, it's interesting. You remember, you're the one who said last week something about the fact that, you know, we used to love the Clinton Foundation and Bill had these great poll numbers and she came out of state with these ridiculously high poll numbers. It's over 60%. And now what? You know, politics can do terrible things. Yeah, we've all worked in foundations in one way or another. We all know how icky it is. And it is an icky thing to raise money for foundations. One of the things that makes me absolutely crazy is when the right, and I'm sorry, Lisa, I have to say this, say she's got a conflict of interest. She's for women, but then they want money from countries that treat women badly. How ridiculous is that? You go into those countries and you hope you can do some work to educate them on just how badly they do treat their young women, their girls. Somebody rescue me here, Susanna. Because honestly, of this is silly, is silly stuff. It just is.
I once did a story on a woman who's a major anti-fracking activist in Texas. And one of the things that the gas industry holds against her is that when she did actually beg to have her land fracked, she sold the rights that she hired a lawyer, and she got a tremendous deal, and she still gets the money. And she said, and I think this kind of is applicable, damn right I'm going to take their money and fight them. And I think that's the same thing that's applicable on that particular issue. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you take your money and then hopefully you do something about it.
There's no evidence that Hillary Clinton ever fought any of these Arab countries that are big donors, especially the Saudis, on all sorts of issues that we find kind of disgusting. And in fact, she turned around and did the opposite of fighting the Iranians who hang their gays and stone women who don't wear their burqas. So I kind of think, yeah, it's true that everything's a little dirty in some ways, but it's also true that to make such a big fuss on the one hand about being the women's candidate and to never really follow through except a few speeches at conferences for women, that's actually...
I don't know, Lisa. Go ahead. This is Sheila.
Nobody has stood up to the Saudis. Not Bush sitting there with Prince Bandar, watching Prince Bandar sit on top of him, flying the whole bin Laden family out when nobody else could fly the next day. Don't blame Hillary for not standing up to the Saudis. Those countries are shameful. And I do think all these foundations attempt, and certainly Melinda Gates does, to do work in these countries. But nobody stands up to the Saudis. We are shameful to the Saudis.
I think Melinda Gates actually does that.
Does what?
I
don't think they fundraise.
Well, the Gates Foundation figures out ways to actually act in some of these places.
Let's not go too off the reservation here. Yeah. I think that the points are there, and I'm sure we'll pick them up again later. But I do want to get to Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. And I'm going to say this. Personally, I find the guy to be a poor excuse for a human being, and I know you're all going to hit me over the head about that.
No.
I simply do not like his style. He's holed up in the embassy of Ecuador. He's a coward. He's accused of rape, and he's hiding behind closed doors. I repeat, he's a coward, and he's trying to influence America's election. He's a power-hungry, crazy, lunatic madman. That's as far as I'm concerned. But as I said, I'm sure everybody's going to have a different point of view. I want to start with Lisa, who actually told me off air that she has mixed feelings about WikiLeaks. So why don't you elaborate why you have mixed feelings, Lisa?
Well, I agree with you that he is kind of a poor excuse for a human. I was going to say something less appropriate. But he's awful, just as Snowden is awful, a traitor, probably a spy. And yet the information that they release is information that I, for one, am happy to know about what's going on. I am not happy at what our government does, and that is all sides of all aisles. But I think it's very important in a democracy for us to have some real sense of what's going on. And I have been very impressed to see the inner workings of the Democratic National Committee be exposed, because really there are 40% of the Democratic Party is unhappy about how their candidate was treated. Good to know what actually happened. There ought to be consequences for these things. I certainly think that's true about national security, which is a very dicey thing. It is, on the one hand, you know, the most important thing a government does for its people, and it requires that secrets be kept. On the other hand, it's very easy for governments to go over the line, deprive us of our privacy, and start running what comes close to being some kind of police state.
Susanna, let me throw it to you, because I know you've done a lot of work on this.
I'm not going to diverge too much from Lisa, but on the subject of Assange, I think there's always been that dichotomy about him, that as a human being, you have questions as to whether you want to be, you know, have dinner with him. But that the proposition that he was putting forward was intriguing and possibly necessary, that there should be, you know, a sort of a watchdog over the powerful and over governments, and that there should be transparency of information out there checking, you know, governments and very powerful people. I think most people would agree with that. However, what I think is happening now that's raising questions for me is that he's introducing the element. Well, I think people are saying that he's always had this element, but he's introducing the element of his personal sort of feuds and dislikes and stuff.
Yes.
And he doesn't like Hillary, and so he wants to bring her down. And, you know, she's gonorrhea, and Trump is syphilis, I think was his comment. So that's where I am now questioning, gosh, you know, what am I even seeing coming out of WikiLeaks? Can I trust that? On the subject of Snowden, I'm gonna differ. Having sort of emailed with him and written about him, I don't think he was a traitor, and I don't think he's a spy, and I think maybe he was a very complicated and possibly sort of misguided young man, but I think that his motives were very honorable, and I think for all that he has all the criticism out there, I think he's done something that was absolutely essential for the health of the politics in our country today.
You don't have to love him in order to hate Assange or vice versa. I don't know that those two peas are in the same pod. That would be my comment on it. And I think you have to take each individual.
I don't even know how well they get along.
Right. I don't think at the moment that they're getting along very well, from what I understand. But I would say this, we have to be careful about putting them both in the same pod, as you will. I think each case needs to be dealt with on its merit or a lack of merit thereof. I want to move on a little bit, Lisa.
Move on, yeah.
Just because I want to take it to this point. I want to throw in the name Bill Maher, who I love.
Huh. What did he do?
Well, Assange was on his show a couple of weeks ago. Did anybody see it?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Oh, go find that on YouTube. What a moment. What a moment. And he called out Bill Maher because Bill had given $1 million to Barack Obama's campaign. And he actually tried to intimate that he has proof that Bill has now given $1 million to Hillary's campaign. But Bill kind of backed off from that. He didn't want to go down that road. So I think that I'm going to use that to do something that you're all going to find a funny pivot. But I'm pivoting to Hollywood.
Good.
In the first part of the show, I did an interview with a really delightful guy named James Andrew Miller, who has written a powerhouse of a book called Powerhouse, CAA, The Untold Story of Hollywood Creative Artists and Agency. I love this book. Do you hear me? I think this is one of the great reads I've had. And you know how many books I get to have to read. Anyway, I want to use that to pivot because I want to say something in all of that is the question of Hollywood and Democrats and the one Republican that may be living within Hollywood. Okay. And we saw that during the convention. Hillary was up to her eyeballs and everybody that you could ever name. And poor old Trump, all he could get was somebody named Antonio Sabato Jr., whose sell date had been over 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the poor guy now is actually saying he's getting more press than he ever could have possibly wanted because he's saying now he's blacklisted. He couldn't get himself a job before this.
Right.
Okay. So there we are. There's this thing going on. And our entire world comes from Hollywood. Hollywood tells us this is what this book CAA is all about. The movies we see, the films we the TV shows we watch, the ads we see, all of this is coming out of CAA, Democratic, Hollywood. Hillary, I'm going to say Hillary talked to me. Look at that, Sheila. I almost called you Hillary. Sheila talked to me.
Call me Hillary? Okay. Okay, well, I don't know. First of all, every single country star is a Republican. I don't know why Trump didn't use more of them. But so there's a big divide, and that's huge. But I think it's pretty hard to dispute that Hollywood is a liberal city. I was touched to – I actually used the word touched to hear about that organization, Friends of Abe, the kind of secret Republican group where, you know, Republicans in the film industry, writers and actors and I guess technicians and, you know, kind of meet kind of privately because it's hard to be a Republican in Hollywood. And I can believe that that's true. I believe it's hard at cocktail parties. And apparently maybe it's hard getting jobs. I don't know. I don't think that's intentional, but I think there's definitely a vibe. Hollywood is kind of liberal. And, you know, so that's kind of interesting to me. And I think maybe Lisa Schifrin knows a little bit about that.
And Lisa, here's my question for you, because you and I on some issues are a lot alike and you know, we're pretty conservative morality wise, but I'm curious as to what you think in terms of they are putting out the morality. The shows are built around the morality. And from a conservative's point of view, you must want to take your head and bang it against the wall when you see some of the stuff that you see on TV.
Hmm. Yes, I do. I think Tipper Gore you saw her get crucified when she stood up to this complex, and nobody's taken them on since. But, you know, and I know the culture war is no longer popular on anybody's side, but really it's ridiculous how much influence Hollywood has. And here's the one funny way this really does tie into this election. Look, Hollywood is obviously liberal and often more than liberal, you know, way, way, way progressive. And also they will, of course, revere somebody like Hillary because all of these women of a certain age, you know, look at her and they see themselves and it's a thing. No, and that's fine. That is what it is. One reason Donald Trump is doing so well or did so well in the primaries, and to the extent that he does well in the future, which nobody wants to call numbers on that, but it is because he is not going through Hollywood. He's speaking over and above the media. He's been using kind of a digital campaign, going through social media and getting around everything that Hollywood does to create a beautiful narrative that, you know, that does in fact shape, but also resonate with our values and our culture.
I'm laughing.
I think that's weird what you just said, because I don't think he's going around Hollywood. He's just going around CNN and MSNBC and Fox. He's going to Fox. He's going where it's safe. That's what he's doing.
I mean, he was a doge by the media.
Exactly. That's a whole different subject though, because we're talking about Hollywood. We're not talking about media. And I think that those two things are not, you know, where I wanted to go.
Hillary fits the narrative of, you know, of somebody striving to overthrow the establishment, and men, white men are dumb and white men are kind of goofy dads and anybody can sort of get rid of them. Hillary is, you know,
I'm not letting you get away with that sentence. That sentence is nuts. What do you mean, Hillary, white men or whatever?
Yeah.
Where did that come from? I mean,
when's the last time you watched a TV show with a dad in it? The dads are treated as if they're kind of goofy and expendable.
Right now, it appears that most men are. I don't know if that's a Hollywood thing. I think that particular instinct, you have to let me finish my sentence. I don't think that that's where I was wanting to go. It's that Hollywood sees culture one way, the democratic way, and I agree with that. And I think that that is problematic because the other voice literally cannot get itself heard unless it goes to Christian broadcasting or something. That's the tone of this conversation that I wanted to keep it, and not who she shot who or Hillary thinks this. That's okay. Politics. We are talking about something different than that.
But I think any conservative would say to you that culture is bigger than politics. And if you've lost the culture, then your politics are not going to resonate. Because really, the two play off of each other very intricately, as I know you know.
Sheila, do you agree? Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Let me just say something. The biggest movie last year or the year before was American Sniper. Huge, so huge that this is a thing that Hollywood does, that any war movie was something they wanted to see. Even wars from 50, 60, 70 years ago, American Sniper was huge. That is not a left-leaning movie. It was not directed by a Democrat. It was directed by Clint Eastwood, starring probably a Democrat, Bradley Cooper, Sienna Miller. But it's not all what you say, Lisa. I mean, you're talking about sitcoms from years ago. I think there are lots of good dads in these sitcoms, including Black-ish. He's, you know, Parenthood. Parenthood went off a couple of years ago, and I don't watch sitcoms particularly. But there are lots of good guys in that. I think you're talking about something from years ago. And again, American Sniper, biggest movie, and the movie that got them all thinking, we want more war movies. Okay? That's Hollywood.
Hollywood is where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hollywood,
if there were no money in those kind of shows, they wouldn't do it. So the culture, it's like the chicken and the egg. I mean, they're reflecting the culture back on itself. They're not departing or diverging from the culture. They're not creating the culture.
Well, they're certainly shaping a lot.
I happen to agree with Lisa on this one. I do think there is a lot of shaping going on. I think a lot of what was on a good note, the LGBT thing, thank God for Hollywood, it would never gotten done if they hadn't started putting that kind of stuff, you know, into their sitcoms and making LGBT people just like you and I, which they are just like you and I. But the other side of the coin is that I do think that it does lean left. And I can understand why people on the right would be a little bit miffed about that and concerned about that because they are conservatives. So we're going to move on real quick. We're going to go to another Hollywood story. We're going from Hollywood to the Carmen Center.
Carmen Center, okay.
Oh, well, where is she going now, Hallie?
Where?
Right? Okay, we're going to burkinis and the ban of burkinis.
A fashion and style.
Oh, there you go. Take it,
I'm
Susanna.
Those for myself. burkini ban. We have a burkini ban in Cannes on the beaches of Cannes, and we now have a burkini ban as of this morning, I think, in Corsica, on the beaches in Corsica.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I guess for me, I'm gonna, you know, the French have a problem, but is this the way to deal with the problem of Islamic terrorism there, Islamic-inspired terrorism? I have to say, from my perspective, I can't even discuss burkinis and burqas without saying that I don't just see it as a symbol of religious faith. As a woman, I see it as a very powerful symbol of women acquiescing. And signifies women subjecting themselves to men and defining themselves in terms of men's tastes and needs and, you know, egregious behavior.
I think Susanna's right, except that I think that sometimes they're not subjecting themselves to what is, in fact, a genuine patriarchy and a lot of misogyny. I think they're being subjected. I think most young girls...
I was being kind, but
you
I agree with you.
I mean, look, I think France's big problem is that they brought in millions of Arabs from their previous colonies, and they did not make a lot of attempt to assimilate them. And now they've got an unassimilated minority that that has changed its views about all sorts of things and is radicalized in ways that have nothing to do with France. You know, we prize religious freedom, possibly, I'm not going to say to excess, but it is one of our biggest priorities in this country. And for them, France is a secular republic, and it ensures that people do not bring divisive religious clothing or symbols into public institutions. They don't let people wear head coverings, hijabs to school. They don't let girls do that. And they insist that they go to school.
Let me interject on that, because I'm glad that you brought that up. The reason they did that actually was one of safety. They were worried that they could hide things under it. Besides the other issue, that was certainly something. And right now Germany is considering doing the same thing, where they have an even bigger problem because they let in so many people and they've had so many bad incidences. And yes, Susanna, go ahead.
I think that Lisa's being just a little bit sort of glossing over this a little bit, this issue of the secularism. Yes, it calls itself a secular republic, but they don't ban people wearing crosses around their necks to the classrooms. And, you know, there is one has, you know, you hit the nail on the head, I think, if they had a minority that they could not and did not assimilate, unlike the United States. We're very, very, very good at that here, and we should see that as a strength. You know, whether we want to or not, our society is elastic, and it embraces and manages to assimilate, perhaps even against people's will, new waves of immigrants. In France, they isolated them. They put them in the suburbs, in the banlieues. They did not sort of have any method to really integrate into French society, and many of them were poor and outcast and isolated and ripe to be radicalized.
Going to leave that there, because guess what time of day it is? It is the end of our 30 minutes. Oh my gosh. It's over till next week. Okay. So here's the deal. Anybody got anything for me? Tell me something I don't know. You want me to start? I will.
Start.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll start. I will start with the fact that it appears that the State Department just announced they'll be releasing all the work-related emails that the FBI recovered from Hillary Clinton's private system. Oh my gosh. Susanna, you got anything?
I just wanted to say something really shallow. And I wanted to say that, having said everything I have to say about the burqa, and I actually think those burkinis are kind of cool. The whole idea of like covering your
crazy girl
with these little skirts and stuff. I mean, except for the head thing, because that is not comfortable to swim when your whole head covered up. I think, you know, the House of Chanel might look at this.
Oh, okay. Okay. That sounds super. How about you, Sheila? You got anything?
Okay. Yeah. I hear from somebody smart that Johnny Depp just settled with Amber Heard for $7 million in divorce. I don't know if that's high or low. I just know that they went at each other. Both of them had a lot of stuff to throw at one another. And his attorney is Laura Wasser, the power celebrity attorney. So, it remains to be seen. But they both seem like very volatile people, and I think she's dating either Elon Musk or some other big internet tech billionaire. So she's not
quitting.
Yeah,
that was Hollywood is like high school. They always have a boyfriend.
Yeah.
I think I better move to Hollywood.
Right.
So Lisa, tell me something I don't know.
Well, I'm going to say something you do know, and that is that Donald Trump gave what is, by pretty much all estimates, a really solid speech on terror, keeping America safe, and how to actually deal in a serious way with the immigration problem that he has gotten so much traction with. It's a little unfair of everybody to criticize this man for not being substantive, and then the minute he's substantive, run away from the content. So I think this is a solid thing he's done, and we'll see where it goes.
There you go, ladies. I want to say I'm offering up my martini glass to you. You guys are so much fun to talk to. What would I do without my weekly conversation with my four bros?
I'm offering up my Pinot Grigio glass.
Cheers.
Here we go.
Cheers.
Clink, clink, clink.
Clink, 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 and kisses, kisses, kisses.
Yep.
Great to talk.
Until next time. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieCasserJane.com.